but it wasn't by some grand decree. If I tried to explain why nobody saw it, once everyone started to see that the world was much smaller than ever before, and over there wasn't so far anymore. What we did unto others washed up on our shore. The answer was hard to ignore. The end of war. The end of war.
Good evening, and welcome to Peace Talk. This show is produced by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community. This is VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak. Tonight's program will again be a discussion about history and its relevance to the wars America is fighting today, in particular, the new battle against the Islamic State, or ISIS, in Syria and Iraq. Later on the show, you'll be listening to Reese Ehrlich, a freelance investigative journalist with extensive experience reporting from the Middle East. Ehrlich was one of the few reporters in Syria covering the early stages of the uprisings against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Before that, he interviewed Assad for his book titled Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. But first, let's begin with a few recent news stories. This weekend, the New York Times reported that 500 scholars, veterans, and activists sent a petition to the Department of Defense demanding that the 50th anniversary commemoration of the Vietnam War include the complete story. Signers of the petition include Lawrence J. Korb, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan, as well as Daniel Ellsberg, Tom Hayden, and a lot of other longtime peace activists. Michael McPherson, executive director of VFP's national organization, told the Times, quote, "One of the biggest concerns for us is that if a full narrative is not remembered, the government will use the narrative it creates to continue to conduct wars around the world as a propaganda tool," end quote. On our August program, we spoke with Norman Solomon about the Gulf of Tonkin incident and other aspects of the hidden history of the Vietnam War. I read the Pentagon's published objectives for this so-called commemoration. The five goals say nothing about the grave mistakes made, says nothing about public opposition to the war or government secrecy that hid the truth from the American public. If you didn't catch it, you can find it in K2's archives under the Special Programs tab and Focus on Community. One piece of Vietnam history that won't be included in the Pentagon's propaganda has to do with Richard Nixon. On the eve of the 68 presidential election, President Johnson accused Nixon of interfering with his efforts to negotiate a ceasefire with North Vietnam. The candidate denied it. Johnson wanted to go public with the documents proving Nixon's diplomatic sabotage, but Clark Gifford, his Secretary of Defense at the time, told him in a taped conversation, quote, "Some elements of the story are so shocking in their nature that I'm wondering whether it would be good for the country to disclose," end quote. Those documents remained under seal until last year. Now, author Ken Hughes, who has studied the Nixon tapes for more than a decade, combines this new evidence to indict Nixon for treason. It's described in his book, Chasing Shadows, The Nixon Tape, The Chenault Affair, and The Origins of Watergate. Nixon died 20 years ago and took that secret to his grave. It was a crime greater than Watergate, but just like the Bush administration's unjust war in Iraq, it was never investigated. Barack Obama came into the presidency with a promise to restore America to the rule of international law. That was part of the reason he won the Nobel Peace Prize less than a year after being elected. Let's take a few minutes and listen to his acceptance speech in Oslo, Norway, in 2009.
To begin with, I believe that all nations, strong and weak alike, must adhere to standards that govern the use of force. I, like any head of state, reserve the right to act unilaterally, if necessary, to defend my nation. Nevertheless, I am convinced that adhering to standards, international standards, strengthens those who do, and isolates and weakens those who don't. The world rallied around America after the 9/11 attacks and continues to support our efforts in Afghanistan because of the horror of those senseless attacks and the recognized principle of self-defense. Likewise, the world recognized the need to confront Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait, a consensus that sent a clear message to all about the cost of aggression. Furthermore, America, in fact, no nation, can insist that others follow the rules of the road if we refuse to follow them ourselves. For when we don't, our actions appear arbitrary and undercut the legitimacy of future interventions, no matter how justified. And this becomes particularly important when the purpose of military action extends beyond self-defense or defense of one nation against an aggressor. More and more, we all confront difficult questions about how to prevent the slaughter of civilians by their own government, or to stop a civil war whose violence and suffering can engulf an entire region. I believe that force can be justified on humanitarian grounds, as it was in the Balkans or in other places that have been scarred by war. Inaction tears at our conscience and can lead to more costly intervention later. And that's why all responsible nations must embrace the role that militaries with a clear mandate can play to keep the peace. America's commitment to global security will never waver, but in a world in which threats are more diffuse and missions more complex, America cannot act alone. America alone cannot secure the peace. This is true in Afghanistan. This is true in failed states like Somalia, where terrorism and piracy is joined by famine and human suffering. And sadly, it will continue to be true in unstable regions for years to come. The leaders and soldiers of NATO countries and other friends and allies demonstrate this truth through the capacity and courage they've shown in Afghanistan. But in many countries, there is a disconnect between the efforts of those who serve and the ambivalence of the broader public. I understand why war is not popular, but I also know this: the belief that peace is desirable is rarely enough to achieve it. Peace requires responsibility. Peace entails sacrifice. That's why NATO continues to be indispensable. That's why we must strengthen UN and regional peacekeeping and not leave the task to a few countries. That's why we honor those who return home from peacekeeping and training abroad, to Oslo and Rome, to Ottawa and Sydney, to Dhaka and Kigali. We honor them not as makers of war, but as wagers of peace. Let me make one final point about the use of force. Even as we make difficult decisions about going to war, we must also think clearly about how we fight it. The Nobel Committee recognized this truth in awarding its first prize for peace to Henri Dunant, the founder of the Red Cross and a driving force behind the Geneva Conventions. Where force is necessary, we have a moral and strategic interest in binding ourselves to certain rules of conduct. And even as we confront a vicious adversary that abides by no rules, I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war. That is what makes us different from those whom we fight. That is a source of our strength. That is why I prohibited torture. That is why I ordered the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed. And that is why I have reaffirmed America's commitment to abide by the Geneva Conventions. We lose ourselves when we compromise the very ideals that we fight to defend. And we honor We honor those ideals by upholding them, not when it's easy, but when it is hard.
So that was President Obama accepting his Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. So 5 years ago, he was telling us we need to abide by international standards. In fact, we need to lead in following international standards to govern the use of force. He added that America can't insist other nations follow these standards if we don't follow them ourselves. And he said we honor those ideals enshrined in the Geneva Conventions when we uphold them, not only when it's easy, but when it's hard. And I want to suggest that upholding them when it's hard includes expanding our responsibility to face our unpleasant truths. It means we must hold accountable those in power who violate the rule of law. It's something Obama and the newly empowered Democrats in Congress refused to even consider after the 2008 election. The President and Congress then and now refused to even initiate investigations into the possibility that America was misled into the Iraq War, that we tortured prisoners, that heads of our government and our military wrongly ordered attacks knowing innocents were unnecessarily in harm's way, or that so much of the mistakes that were made were wrongly covered up. George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and others should have had to answer to a full-fledged investigation for the world to trust that America does indeed believe the rule of law applies to our nation. Now, there's one more story I want to mention. It has to do with the use of depleted uranium in Iraq. Last month, the Iraq Veterans Against the War and the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Department of Defense requesting that the use of depleted requesting information on the use of depleted uranium used in the Iraq War. Depleted uranium is a kind of an Agent Orange of the Iraq War. It's worth noting here, too, that tonight's guest, Reese Erlich, wrote an article about the use of depleted uranium ammunition that Project Censored voted in 2003 as the eighth most censored story in America. Now, these failures, to be honest with ourselves, doom us to repeat the mistakes of the past, and that's part of what is happening now in Syria and Iraq. Because as you'll hear in this interview that was recorded yesterday, the U.S. government is still intent on fighting a bad war with actors it can't trust, while misleading the American people, just like Presidents Johnson, Nixon, and George W. Bush did. So let me introduce Reese Erlich. As I mentioned earlier in the program, he was in northern Iraq at the start of the U.S. bombing campaign against the Islamic State. He interviewed Kurdish leaders, Peshmerga fighters, and U.S. officials. With that on-the-ground knowledge, he had a piece published in TruthDig.org and CommonDreams.org titled 10 Myths About Obama's Latest War in Syria and Iraq. Ehrlich's history in journalism goes back over 40 years. He worked as a staff writer and research editor for Ramparts, an investigative reporting magazine published in San Francisco. Today, he works as a full-time print and broadcast freelance reporter. He regularly reports for National Public Radio, the Canadian broadcast system for radio stations in Canada, stations in Australia, Germany, and Marketplace Radio. His articles appear in the San Francisco Chronicle and Global Post. His television documentaries have been aired on PBS stations nationwide. Erlich is the author of 5 books, including Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War, and What the World Can Expect. That was released just this past week. He also co-authored with Norman Solomon a 2003 bestseller titled Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. Another relevant book to our subject tonight is Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire, published in 2010. Erlich interviewed 6 Middle East leaders, often labeled as terrorists, including Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Peter Coyote was present for 2 of those interviews and says in his review of the book that Erlich conducts a tough interview and is in no one's pocket. He enters the room well-armed with history and fact, and his questions are probing, hard, but fair. Erlich has received several awards for his radio documentaries, including Inside the Syrian Revolution, for the best radio explanatory journalism by the Society of Professional Journalists in Northern California. And the San Francisco Board of Directors declared September 14, 2010, to be Reese Ehrlich Day in honor of his investigative journalist work. The resolution read, in part, "Investigative reporters are under attack in the U.S. and around the world. Mr. Ehrlich exhibits the finest qualities of such reporters willing to confront the afflicted and afflict the comfortable." Let's listen to what Ehrlich has to say about America's newest wars in Syria and Iraq. In 2010, you published a book, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. One of the six leaders you interviewed was Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. A year later, the uprising against his regime began, and that was in concert with the Arab Spring. Over the course of months, you went to Syria. You were one of the few journalists who traveled there, I believe, one of the few to cover the story. And over the course of months, you spoke with opposition and supporters of his regime, people from diverse ethnic backgrounds, and people from all over the country. Can you give us a summary of your experiences there and what you've learned and how it's relevant today?
I first reported from Syria in 2002. I've been there five times and visited virtually all of the neighboring countries, interviewing Syrian exiles, rebels, supporters of Assad, people of different ethnic and religious backgrounds. And in 2011, in March, there was a genuinely popular uprising against Assad that cut across class lines and religious and ethnic lines. Sunni and Shia were marching together. Alawites joined in. Christians joined in. But fairly quickly, the Assad government played a divide-and-conquer role and split off Christians, Alawites, Shia as minorities from the Sunni majority. And soon the Sunni majority was not gaining the allies that they had initially. Today, the situation is that the Assad government controls about one-third of the country, from Damascus up to close to the Lebanese border, and the various rebel groups control the rest. There are some Free Syrian Army, some independent, and some ultra-conservative Islamic groups, such as the Islamic State. And the outside powers have intensified their interference in Syria, including the United States and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and others on the anti-Assad side, and the Iranian and Hezbollah from Lebanon forces backing Assad. So for the moment, the civil war is a stalemate, with neither side really able to make a decisive victory over the other.
But the civil war didn't begin until, months after the more, I don't want to call it nonviolent, because it wasn't completely nonviolent, but the protest that began during the Arab Spring. What caused it to morph into a civil war?
Yes. For the roughly first eight months to a year, it was mainly demonstrations, not armed struggle. The main political force was the Muslim Brotherhood and people allied with conservative political Islam, and secular and progressive forces who were not particularly identified as part of political Islamic parties, but were very much against the Assad regime. They were very creative. I wrote about it in Conversations with Terrorists, and I write about it again in my new book, Inside Syria, where very creative tactics, trying to build support among different sectors. But the Assad regime used both divide-and-conquer tactics politically and quite brutal repression to make it very difficult for the rebels to function with their protests. And they increasingly turned to armed struggle. The Assad government claimed that Israel and U.S. and Saudi Arabia had been promoting terrorist attacks from the very beginning of the demonstrations, and it's simply a lie. It's very similar to what the Bush administration did to try to discredit anyone who opposed U.S. policy, is to call them Al-Qaeda, call them a terrorist, and Assad borrowed a page from that playbook. But after roughly a year, the groups turned to armed struggle. It became impossible to hold these big demonstrations, and the Civil War broke out.
So when the Civil War broke out, were there still attempts by some of these groups to avoid the armed conflict?
There were. There even to this day, there are some peace activists mainly engaged in social welfare group activities, such as health care and education, trying to bring in supplies to besieged areas. Those folks are still around, although they're not a strong political force. The possibility of just normal protests receded as under the strong repression. And so some of those folks joined armed groups, some went into exile, some were forced to just drop out altogether. But there's not what we call them, the civil society activists. They're there in Syria, but they're not in significantly organized groups.
So in your documentary, your radio documentary from 2011, you interviewed quite a few different people from all different parts of the country and all different backgrounds, but that also included people who supported Assad's regime. And as I listened to those, I was struck by some of the similarities between those supporters and former supporters of Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, in the sense that Assad was credited with keeping a lid on some of the religious, the sectarian disputes. It was a secular government. How did the United States government view Assad prior to the uprising in light of him being a secular leader?
Yeah, that's an important point, which is that both Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad were secular dictators, not religious dictators. And as such, Christians, for example, felt a certain amount of sympathy with both of them, not because they liked dictators, but because they were seen as the lesser of two evils, and they didn't want to see themselves dominated by ultra-conservative and extremist groups using Islam as the excuse to propel themselves into power. The U.S. Has a mixed attitude towards Assyria. The Hafez al-Assad, who is the current president's father, actually allied with the U.S. and sent troops in the first Gulf War when Saddam Hussein attacked Kuwait and the U.S. put together a coalition in the first Gulf War. And Syria was part of that coalition, actually sent troops and tanks into the war. And that was because Hafez al-Assad saw Saddam Hussein as a bigger enemy than the United States. It was also right at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Syria was hoping to find a new ally with the United States, but that effort never went anywhere, mainly because the U.S. insists on backing Israel, and Syria has serious differences, criticisms, opposition has been at war with Israel at different times, and specifically the return of the Golan Heights is an area of dispute because in 1967, Israel seized the Golan Heights from Syria, annexed it, and refuses to give it back. And no Syrian government is going to be able to cut a deal with the U.S. without that issue being resolved. And they were not able to do so. So later in 2000, that was about 1990-91. Then in 2000, Hafez al-Assad, the father, died, and his son, Bashar, was miraculously elected by the parliament to become the new president. And at first, the U.S. looked favorably on him, partly because he did lift some of the political restrictions, but mainly because he started adopting neoliberal economic policies. He privatized state-owned industries. He allowed private entrepreneurs greater room to invest. And the U.S. hoped that foreign companies, and specifically U.S. companies, would be allowed to come in and open up the market to the benefit of the United States. When that failed to happen, the U.S. turned off its support or its willingness to possibly work with Assad. And most importantly, the U.S. wanted Assad to break with Iran. Syria and Iran had longstanding alliance. They are dating back to the 1980s. And the U.S. wanted to, as part of helping Israel and isolating Iran, the U.S. wanted Assad to stop its alliance, its economic, political, and military ties with Iran. When the Syrian government refused to do that, then the relations got cold again. The U.S. imposed sanctions. And even then, when the war first broke out, or sorry, the uprising of 2011 first broke out, the U.S. took a wait-and-see attitude, as did Israel, by the way. Far from supporting the rebels, they were worried that the rebels were conservative adherents of political Islam, and they might not be pro-U.S. And Assad, while he was a brutal dictator, he was secular dictator, and he had kept the border with Israel quiet for over 40 years. So the U.S. and Israel were wary about backing the movement to overthrow Assad. After a few months, it became clear that the popular movement was going to continue and had genuine mass support, and the U.S. Ultimately called for the overthrow of Assad, and that is still the official policy. Ironically, of course, is that with this latest war, with the U.S. Now dropping bombs on the Islamic State in Syria, the Islamic State is opposed to Assad. When the U.S. bombs the Islamic State, it helps Assad. So the very guy that we claim that we're trying to overthrow is now getting military assistance from the United States.
So didn't Israel bomb Syria earlier, long before the United States reached that point?
Yes. The Israel bombed Syria with impunity. In 2007, they bombed what they claimed was a nuclear facility in the making. It turns out it was really just a regular military base. And after a total of, I believe it's now a total of five times, Israel has bombed Syria with the justification that it was attacking Hezbollah sites, weapons or missiles being transferred to Hezbollah, which is the Lebanese group, political party and militia that's helping Assad. But, you know, you bomb Assad or his allies and you're helping the rebels. So, yes, Israel has, and that predated the most recent August strikes by the U.S.
And what about the Kurdish population in Syria, in Iraq, and then there's Turkey with a Kurdish population and a Kurdish desire for self-rule? How does that all play into all this?
Well, it's worth going back very briefly to look at Kurdish history. I have a whole chapter on the Kurds in my book, Inside Syria. The after World War I, the colonial powers had actually signed a treaty that called for a referendum, a vote, by the people of the Kurdish region in Turkey, Iraq, and Syria as to whether they wanted to be independent. But the colonial powers and Turkey reneged on that treaty, and such a vote never took place. The Kurds are a separate people. They speak their own language. They have their own culture and history. They're not Arabs. They're not Turks. But they have never been allowed the right to unify as a people. They're the largest ethnic group without a country in the world. Now, having said that, the demands of Kurds in different countries are different. So in both Turkey and in Syria, the Kurds are not demanding to create separation and creating their own state. They're demanding autonomy within the existing countries, that is, within Turkey and within Syria. There's about 15 political parties among the Kurds in Syria. That number may have gone up. I haven't checked this morning, but they're very fragmented. But what has emerged as the strongest party in Syria is a group called the PYD, which is affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers Party in Turkey. The Kurdistan Workers Party is a nationalist group that the U.S. and Turkey call terrorists. So, for example, the PKK-affiliated group in Syria is the ones fighting in Kobani, the town near the Turkish border that's getting so much publicity in recent days. So the U.S. is dropping bombs on the Islamic State to stop them from a victory over a group that the U.S. considers to be terrorists. It's one more indication that the politics of the new war the U.S. is waging is far more complicated than the U.S. wants to let on.
The United States is portraying the terrorists, as we like to label everybody we fight, in a very monolithic picture. And just as the resistance in Syria started out with a wide variety of interests, the rebels that are fighting have the same thing, and so don't the opposition to the United States. To what you're basically saying is that nothing's monolithic at all. It's a very, very confusing situation.
Yeah, it's very complicated, and the minute you choose to support one side, you're going to alienate another who might have been your ally last week. And when you intervene militarily, it just makes it even worse, because everybody, on the one hand, a certain group of people want you to expand your military attacks to help them, and the other group is going to be permanently alienated from the U.S. because you are engaging in military action. And the U.S. is going to come up, there's no winning way with military action. And in fact, by attacking the Islamic State with air raids, which are not all that effective, the U.S. is actually increasing the prestige, increasing the likelihood of recruitment, and helping the Islamic State in the long run.
So we're kind of going backwards, just like we did with al-Assad, opposing him in the beginning. Now we're helping him. We're going to attack IS, the Islamic State, and help Kurdish terrorists that we normally don't want to help.
Unless, of course, they magically become un-terrorists. But that's always a possibility. The U.S. Names groups and calls groups terrorists willy-nilly, depending on their immediate political situation. And in fact, the PKK are not terrorists. They're a nationalist group that's been fighting for some years. I have strong disagreements with them, but it doesn't help to call them terrorists.
Well, and all these relationships are short-term, both on the other side of the world, where they're all looking at America as a potential ally or enemy, which can change, but the United States, you're saying, also changes its allies willy-nilly.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this idea that if we're weak in Syria, it'll affect U.S. policy around the world, that's, frankly, I don't go for it. Everybody in the world has their own set of problems. Whether the U.S. should be involved or not is a local decision. And people don't look at Syria and say, aha, the U.S. didn't give enough arms to a rebel group in Syria, therefore I'm going to take up arms against my government and the U.S. isn't going to do anything. Or, I mean, each situation is different and people have their own perceptions of the U.S. The Obama administration had a policy in Syria. It wasn't weak or vacillating. The policy didn't work. The U.S. tried finding and arming so-called moderates. They got their butts wiped by other forces and their weapons taken away. So it hasn't been a vacillation. It's the problem is the U.S. hasn't found a horse to back and isn't going to, because basically the people of Syria are not interested in having a new domination by the United States, and the U.S. hasn't been able to find a group who would favor that.
Well, you are on the ground. The United States intelligence agencies should be relying on having people on the ground. It's been a criticism over the years that we don't have enough people out there. I know in your book, Conversation with Terrorists, Robert Baer, he wrote the foreword to the book, a former CIA operative from the Middle East. He was someone on the ground who has also criticized the fact that there's not a lot of people on the ground these days. Now, so from a journalist perspective, do you feel that the few journalists working there have a better relationship with people on the ground to get the true information to what's really going on and how people feel?
Yeah, I think with some exceptions, a good journalist on the ground has a lot more information than the diplomats reading the cables from the CIA have. In fact, I've had diplomats tell me that they often got more useful information from the New York Times or other mainstream media than they did from their own classified cables from the intelligence agencies. When I go into a country, as do other reporters who are doing their job right, you get out, you talk to ordinary people, you talk to middle-level leaders of the opposition, of the governing parties and institutions, not necessarily the top people, because they'll often just spin a web of lies. But if you can manage to find the middle-level people who really know what's going on, you can piece together information that may not be available from other sources. So, for example, I did reporting for the Global Post from Saudi Arabia. I revealed that Saudi Arabian government, along with rich businessmen and sheikhs from Saudi Arabia, were supporting al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate fighting in Syria, and from which the Islamic State emerged. So if I could figure it out, certainly the CIA and people with lots more resources than I do could figure it out. But it was uncomfortable. It was inconvenient. So I don't know whether they reported it internally, but they certainly didn't publicize it. It leads to some very dangerous conclusions, because right now the U.S. claims that it's going to train moderate rebels from Syria in Saudi Arabia. That is, rebels fighting inside Syria will be vetted, supposedly determined that they're moderates, whatever that means, sent to Saudi Arabia for training, and then returned to Syria. Well, the Saudis not only backed al-Qaeda for a long time, they ideologically, and their interpretation of Islam, is very close to the teachings of al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. So having the Saudis train people is an absolute guaranteed disaster in the making. It's like asking Chicago police cadets to be trained by Al Capone.
Well, what about our training? And this brings us over to Iraq, where the Iraqi defense forces just pretty much disappeared as the Islamic State started moving into their territory. When we trained the Iraqi army before we left, how effective can the United States be at actually accomplishing that when, you know, we're training fighters to fight in ways we don't fight anymore because we have a lot more weaponry, a lot more protection for our foot soldiers? And do we not limit our training in fear of, in Iraq's case anyways, when they became more allied or a little bit even allied with Iran? Wouldn't the United States be a little concerned about training them too much?
Yeah. See, in this country, the concept of training means, at least in the popular discourse, means providing weapons and how to fire certain kinds of weapons and how to launch an attack or an ambush and military training. But a lot of what really goes on, particularly behind the scenes, is finding military officers particularly who are sympathetic to the U.S. or who could be made sympathetic to the U.S. to establish long-term back-channel ties. Because if you notice, in every time there's a coup or a uprising in which the military gets involved, the U.S. has contacts with certain of the generals and the officers that it makes contact with to point the uprising or the coup in a pro-U.S. direction, if that's at all possible. So the training is, yes, on military matters, but it's also undermining the government to have an officer corps and particularly intelligence officers who are closely tied to the U.S. regardless of who the government is. And that's what the U.S. tried to do in Iraq, and I think it backfired because the Iranians were doing the same thing. And whereas the U.S. came in as the occupying force in 2003, the Iranians had acted as a refuge for the Shia political parties who had been opposed to Saddam Hussein for decades. And when the U.S. sent in its troops, Iran sent its political operatives and its exiled leaders, who later became top leaders of the government and of the military. And they were not willing to cooperate with the U.S. in its efforts to undermine the military. Secondly, the Iraqi army was never a national army in the sense that we understand it. The sections of the military were loyal to the Shia leaders and militia and political parties. The Kurdish part of it, the Peshmerga, was always loyal to the two political parties in Kurdistan, not to the Baghdad government. So you had what appeared to be a national army. They wore the same uniforms and they used the same U.S. weapons and fired the same ammunition and so on. But in reality, it was a fragmented force that was politically weak, and particularly the Sunnis who were in the army had no real loyalty to the Shia leaders in Baghdad. So when the Islamic State attacked in June of this year, the Iraqi army basically dissolved. The guys took off their uniforms, left their weapons, abandoned their tanks, and went home. And so did their officers.
And corruption seems to have been a problem with that. What I've read, that when the officers take charge with American support, they're getting salaries, they're getting money, it's not going to the right places, and when things fall apart, they're the first to leave.
Yes, exactly. And the corruption is usually blamed on the Iraqis, but let's give the U.S. its due for its role in it, too. Then today's New York Times had an article, $1.6 billion of money shipped from the United States to Baghdad went missing. And it ended up in a bunker in Lebanon, and nobody knows who quite controls it or what happened to the money or what it was used for. The U.S. had massive funding in an effort to buy its way into power in Iraq. That helped foster corruption because they literally were passing out shrink-wrapped $100 bills to anybody who would accept it and pledge their allegiance to the United States. Well, anybody, think if you were in a situation in the U.S. and you needed some money and someone was handing out for free, you'd promise them anything and then turn around and do whatever you wanted anyway. And that's exactly what happened in Iraq. So in that context, yes, the military officers were skimming the money off the top that was supposed to go to their men, keeping it for themselves, so the soldiers were going sometimes weeks and months without getting paid. They'd sell off the weapons, sometimes to the enemy, in order to make an additional profit. And a somewhat less severe, but nevertheless quite serious situation went on with the Peshmerga in Kurdistan. I didn't know it till I got there on my most recent trip. A Peshmerga recruit has to, when he joins the military, has to bring his own sidearm and ammunition because they can't afford to pay him and provide that for their recruits. And why is that? Because the military officers and the top leadership have skimmed the money off the top just as they do in the rest of Iraq.
The Kurdish people in Iraq, they were not beneficiaries of American armed support in terms of bringing weapons and so forth.
No, that's what they claim. But I've been covering this long enough. I was there in the 2000s, in the late 2000s. I personally visited and interviewed Kurdish soldiers who were being trained by the American military in Sulaymaniyah, which is one of the two largest cities in Kurdistan. So the U.S. was, now it was done, and this is where the wording gets tricky. Supposedly, the U.S. was training Iraqi soldiers who happened to be Kurds and happened to be living in Kurdistan. So technically, I suppose they could claim they weren't training the Peshmerga and providing them with arms. But these folks, and they did indeed wear Iraqi army uniforms. But in reality, they were loyal to their political party in Kurdistan, as were all the other Peshmerga. So the U.S., while claiming to be arming the Iraqi army, was in fact providing arms and training to the Peshmerga loyal to one of the two leading parties in that area.
That's confusing to me.
The complaint is that the Kurdish leadership complains that they didn't get enough weapons. They want tanks. They want shoulder-fired missiles. They want much more sophisticated weapons to fight the Islamic State.
Prior to that, when they claimed they weren't getting the same support, was the United States withholding something because we were concerned about Kurdish separatists, or were they actually getting it and the United States was claiming we weren't supporting them for the sake of Iraqi unity?
Well, as far as the Kurdish leadership is concerned, is they were not getting enough support from the United States. They were getting some, but they wanted more. And it's a convenient excuse to explain why they fared so badly in the fight with the Islamic State. They had to retreat in all across northern Iraq when confronted by the Islamic State. And they say, oh, well, that's because we're outgunned. We never got the same kind of support that the Iraqi army got, blah, 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 blah. But that was a convenient excuse. In reality, the Peshmerga and the top leadership in Erbil had cut a deal with supporters of the Islamic State to have a non-aggression pact where they would not attack the Islamic State in the Kurdish area, in the Arab areas, if the Islamic State wouldn't attack Kurdistan. And for a couple months that worked, and the Kurdish region actually expanded by 40%, including taking over Kirkuk, which is the vital oil fields. And when the Islamic State in July and August particularly reneged on that and started attacking the Kurdish forces, they were caught unawares politically, and they had to retreat. And they weren't able to regroup really until the U.S. bombing started. And that's when we heard all these complaints about how the U.S. hadn't armed them and so on and so forth.
And Turkey's perspective on this, we talked about that a bit earlier, that the Turkish and the United States considers parts of the Kurdish separatists as a terrorist group. I actually hosted an exchange student from Diyarbakir, which is part of the Kurdish region in Turkey, learned firsthand from her for the first time in my life how oppressed or discriminated against Kurds are in Turkey. How does that complicate the picture with our relations with Turkey to have us supporting Kurdish fighters to oppose the Islamic State?
Yeah, you're referring to the PKK, or the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is often called a separatist group. It's not. Roughly 20 years ago, they gave up that position and called for autonomy within Turkey. And their affiliated group has the same position in Syria. That is, they call for greater Kurdish autonomy within Syria, but not separation or creation of a separate state. So that, and calling them terrorists, are the kind of two big lies that the U.S. and Turks propagate. Now, the Kurdistan Workers' Party is a has a significant base in the Kurdish region in Turkey. They have people who are not formally affiliated with them, but nevertheless, everybody knows that they represent the same political trend, who get elected as mayors and local council people and members of parliament and so on. And the Turkish government is trying to negotiate some kind of a settlement inside Turkey with the PKK. However, the Turkish government is very wary of the PKK becoming stronger in Syria, even though they know they're only fighting for autonomy. And so the current fight in Kobani, that's one of the reasons why things are so confusing, because the people fighting in Kobani, the town near the Turkish border that's getting so much publicity, are PKK-affiliated folks. And Turkey doesn't want to come to their help, because that would strengthen the PKK inside Turkey. So they're sitting by and waiting, watching people get slaughtered, and the Islamic State possibly taking over the town of Kobani, because the Turks are unwilling to step in. The Turks are now calling for a no-fly zone over parts of Syria that they would control. And by their control, they would make sure that the PKK didn't have much influence in that part of Syria. So as I said, it's very complicated, because everybody's got their own solution, wants the U.S. to jump on board, and it has very serious medium and long-term implications for who the U.S. ends up backing or not.
Let's talk about the U.S. All these other factions fighting in the Middle East are obviously fighting for their territory and their lives. The United States is on the other side of the world, and a lot of the justification for the airstrikes and arming the Syrian rebels, the airstrikes in Iraq, are that the Islamic State is a threat to the United States. How real is that?
Yeah, it's another big scare tactic. Your listeners may remember the roll-up to the Iraq War of 2003. Saddam Hussein was harboring terrorists who were building suitcase bombs who were going to come bomb Chicago, and all manner of other tall tales that turned out to be completely wrong and, in fact, manufactured to whip up pro-war sentiment. And we're seeing a similar situation today. In fact, the lie didn't last 2 weeks. The initial argument was that the Islamic State was a fearsome terrorist force that was going to launch attacks with its secret agents on Europe and the United States. When the U.S. started bombing Syria, the Obama administration admitted publicly that actually the Islamic State was not much of a threat to people in the United States. But there was a new, fearsome, really terrorist group called the I can't even remember the name of the group that came and went so fast, Kobar. And they were the real terrorists who were ready, had operational plans to attack the United States. A couple of days later, newspaper articles covered comments from the intelligence agency say, well, they didn't actually have any operational plans. They were thinking about it. So the U.S. has to scare people by convincing us that we're under threat from terrorist attack, and therefore bombing some people far away is going to help stop that. If anything, it produces more recruits who get angry at the United States and increases the chances of such attacks, which are slim to begin with.
The beheadings of journalists, which you must have some personal feelings about, seem to excite the public in desire for, you know, some sort of defensive action. The beheadings seem to be sensationalized. Are they really aimed at inciting American intervention for their own benefit, sort of like what happened in what people believe bin Laden did, that it is a recruiting tactic?
Well, let me just go back for a second. The group, the fearsome terrorist group, the new one that nobody had ever heard of, is called the Khorasan. And the U.S. tried to claim that the Khorasan is a new, really, really dangerous group, much more dangerous even than the Islamic State. So to justify even more bombing. So the reasons for our war continue to shift, and you really can't trust a war when they can't even agree on why it is that we're waging the war. Any freelance or working journalist in that area worries about being kidnapped and the horrific tactics adopted by these folks. Some people have been ransomed. Some have been horribly killed or tortured or killed in some cases. And I think I take the Islamic State at their word, which is that they beheaded the two journalists after the U.S. started the bombing. They said that it's in response to the bombing, and they simultaneously called on people in Australia, the U.S., and Europe to carry out terrorist attacks against ordinary Americans. I think I accept that at strict value. I don't think they're and there are some people who might get recruited to a group because of those beheadings. Most people are appalled, including most Muslims, that such activities could be carried out in the name of Islam. And, of course, the U.S. took far more advantage of their atrocities to launch its most recent attacks. I would simply point to the horrible Boko Haram, another extremist group in Nigeria that kidnapped the teenage girls and took them into sex slavery or whatever. And that was a horrible crime, but at no point did the U.S. suggest sending in U.S. troops and bombing in Nigeria in order to resolve it, because we all realize that the people of Nigeria have to take care of that issue themselves. And it's no different for the situation in Iraq and Syria. Why don't we have time for about one more question.
Let's talk a little bit about the mainstream media then. You're obviously freelance. You get some of your work published in the mainstream. But the mainstream media's responsibility for feeding this American fear that something's going to happen over here. How much does the mainstream media play in American support for our government's actions?
Yeah, I think they act as a transmission belt for the warmongering coming out of Washington and is dutifully reported to the American people, particularly in the period when the war first starts. There tends to be not much critical reporting. So the Pentagon issues a video of a missile supposedly hitting with pinpoint accuracy on an Islamic terrorist target, and their media dutifully runs that on the air. When Human Rights Watch and others on the ground say at least some of those missiles are hitting civilians and killing innocent people, the Pentagon says, well, we don't have any information on that. And that's somehow accepted as normal. There are lots of good reporters, knowledgeable reporters over in the Middle East. I've met some of them. Some of them are struggling hard to get accurate reporting out. But unfortunately, the perspective on what's going on in Syria, Iraq, is reported from the parameters or from the perspective of the debate in Washington between hawks who want to see a greater escalation of the war and humanitarian interventionists who want a lesser intervention in the war, but the war nonetheless. What is not reported is the many Americans and many people of the region who don't want to see any U.S. intervention whatsoever. That's off the table because, so far at least, major Democratic and Republican leaders in Washington aren't advocating that position, so therefore it's not legitimate, even though significant numbers of Americans and people in the region actually don't want to see any U.S. interference.
Thank you, Reese, for taking the time out to talk with me this morning. I greatly appreciate that you've brought some of your history to our listeners.
Glad to
your knowledge. You've been listening to Reese Ehrlich, a freelance reporter with extensive experience covering Syria and the Kurdish region of Iraq, where America is now bombing ISIS. If you want more information about the Syrian civil war, consider purchasing his new book, Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. It'll probably explain, just as you heard from Reese, that much more about how the conflict is well beyond America's ability to solve, especially with our military. which reminds us all that our military failed to solve or the problem it created in Iraq. It embarrassed President Bush after he declared mission accomplished way back in 2003, just a few months after the war began. It wasn't over when President Bush left office, even though President Obama pulled troops out in 2012 and in his own politically convenient way called it a success story. We now see it never really was over, as we're back fighting in Iraq. So anyway, that's our story for tonight, our show for tonight. I'm Rich Moniak. This is Peace Talk on KTOO in Juneau. I want to thank Reese Ehrlich for taking out his Sunday morning. That was a pre-recorded interview, by the way. He talked to me yesterday morning here in the studio. And again, put a plug in for his book, Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. I also want to thank John and Dolly Kremers, who are sitting here at the studio running the board, something I still seem to be incapable of doing. I want to thank Jeff Brown for his usual support. Jeff helped me get the system set up to Skype with Reese yesterday and make sure I wasn't broadcasting it live on the air at that time. Also want to thank K2 for use of the airwaves. This is a privilege that VFP has to talk about national issues on a local program, national issues that affect Juneau, affect people throughout Alaska. We have a large military presence in Alaska, but we're also Americans. And as Reese said, there's a lot of Americans right now who are tired of war and need to hear a different narrative other than let's bomb somebody. Again, you've been listening to Peace Talk on KTOO. Remember to take a stand against our government's endless deceptions to prosecute an endless war. And with that, I'll say goodnight.